Hello and welcome to this week's live instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And today we're going to be looking at a topic that's quite a hot topic in global reflation, hot trade or hot air. I'm joined today by our special guest, I guess I could almost say. Was it last time we saw you here, David, was August, I think we worked out. Our chief strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. G'day, David.
I'm back, Tim.
You are back. We won't ask you where you've been. Apparently Mordor was thrown up, but anyway. And also our head of investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Fantastic. All right, so let's jump into it. And of course, we'll kick off with the agenda for today. So we're going to be kicking off with the topic of global reflation. We're then going to be looking into rational optimism, rolling then across into irrational exuberance, and finishing off, as always, with an investment outlook on how we run money and incorporate these themes every day in the portfolios of the MB Fund and Nucleus Wealth. So with no further ado, let's start off with global reflation. Gents.
So yeah, we're going to kick off here with kind of digging into the narrative that's been driving this really strong bid in equity markets over the last month or so. And, you know, there is an argument behind it about a turn in global growth that could drive earnings or will drive earnings, according to the bulls. And certainly a key component to it, if not the keystone, is central bank easing globally. Has been going on now for, 12 months or so, but intensified very recently, especially in developed economies, when the Fed backflipped and started feeding money back into repo markets and what have you. And they've denied that they're doing quantitative easing, but they are doing it. And as this chart is sort of hinting at, we're early on here, is developed markets have stopped their quantitative tightening, at least, even if easing is still an open question. And as you can see on the chart, they'd all been falling away for the last 2 years ago, 2 years or so, as central banks were buying less and less assets. And now, the major turn has been in the Fed, but there's also been a pivot in Europe with the ECB.
But not as noticeable, though, in Europe.
Not as noticeable,
It's more it stopped falling rather than started rising.
Correct, yeah. So, I mean, the ECB's basically running out of stuff to buy. That might explain why it's not rising so strongly.
It's always stuff to buy. Japan's an example there. Well, Japan buys equities as well.
Yes.
So I think it owns, there's some of the ETFs there where it owns, I think, 75% or something of the ETFs on issue. So it basically goes out and buys index funds effectively to help bid the stock market along.
support
the stock market. Yeah. And it's just incredible some of the numbers there. So you can see on that chart, Japan with an economy half the size of the US, I want to say, maybe. I don't know. Maybe less than half the size of the US has got, way more assets in the central bank, and they just keep rising and rising and rising.
Yep. Well, I look forward to the day when the RBA launches quantitative easing and bypasses bonds and just buys houses directly.
they're kind of doing that essentially with this underwriting of the first home buyers grant in Australia.
Well, the RBA is not involved in that.
Okay.
But when there's default and the government takes it back on its balance sheet, maybe the RBA can buy back on it. Yeah. Yes.
There is a certain inevitability to it all. So this is the sort of one of the key sentiment drivers, as well as liquidity drivers, that's got markets excited. And so phase two in the sudden turn towards optimism for global growth, if you want to flip over there, Tim, is, of course, there's been this turn towards negotiation in the trade war over the last couple of months. The deal is very thin, but it's been enough for markets to simply see things not get worse. And this is a handy chart from the FT, which is kind of indicating that trade volumes globally have sort of bottomed out. In the second derivative, that is, so they're getting worse more slowly.
Mm. Yeah. And can I just describe this chart as well for anyone listening along, but also for people who don't understand what it is. So this is a PMI, I believe, is it? A Purchasing Manager Index. So basically what you're doing is asking people are things getting better or are things getting worse in terms of, and they break it down to just people in the export industry. And so above 50 is expanding mm-hmm. and below 50 is contracting. And so the line sort of come down from sort of the low 50s, sort of passed through 50 about the start of this year, maybe about this time last year, passed through 50 and went negative. And it's pretty clearly bottomed. So it was quite negative in September of this year. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it's actually sort of been rising quite quickly. The PMI, but still contracting, just not on a fast scale.
Yeah, and there were probably a part of this is just a base effect as well, where
you get used to things.
Used to things, and they stop getting worse, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get better either. But so anyway, this is certainly another key plank in the argument that there's a global recovery on the way, and that's going to benefit earnings. And therefore bid stocks.
Mm. Just quickly as well, just for those listening in on the podcast, as always, we've got a link to a PDF of the chart pack in the show notes as well, if you're wondering where these charts are. So head over there.
Yep. Okay, so flip over to the next one. And this is something that we've been pretty strong on all year, and one reason why we never really bought the notion that there was going to be a US recession, at least without further shocks, which we thought were odds on and still are, actually. But basically, when we had the Federal Reserve turned to easing, and we already, it was more or less chasing the bond market panic that we saw earlier in the year when growth started to fall. As markets felt the Fed had fallen behind, plus the trade stuff was getting worse and worse. And what that means in the US is that yields on the long end of the bond curve fall, and US mortgages are priced, they're fixed price mortgages, not floating, and they price off the long end of the bond curve. Mm-hmm. And so that means basically there were big interest rate cuts for people who wanted to refinance or get a new mortgage. Mm. And so
And just to put that again, just to take that one step further back. So in Australia, we run all off the short end. So the floating rate is basically, and you can, if you're braver, you can talk about 3-year or maybe even a 5-year fixed mortgages.
But you normally pay up for those anyway.
So, yeah. The US ones, you can get 30-year fixed. So it's a very different market. Yeah. So as that 30-year comes down.
And so as the rates fall, people then refinance rather than just see automatic cuts in their repayments.
Yes.
And so you get these what are called refi booms. And so, following through from that, we're seeing reasonable growth in US house prices, like they had been slowing as the Fed tightened, and that started to turn around. But more importantly for economic activity, we'll start to see, and we are seeing, new levels of housing construction in the US economy. And there's virtually never been a US recession that wasn't led by a downturn, or at least, party to a big downturn in the housing market and housing construction in particular. And this chart from Credit Suisse just shows you that the mortgage activity has bounced heavily or sharply. And secondly, it shows that there's a, pretty good relationship between that and US manufacturing, which then starts to chase, higher housing activity. Because it's got to manufacture more stuff to build houses with.
And the other supporting in that housing market is the US housing market never really recovered from the it's sort of overbuilt in the early 2000s. So the level of house building, even though the US sort of housing crash happened sort of 2007, 2008, and you saw dramatic levels fall away in terms of the construction. While that recovered over the next 10 years, it never really recovered to the levels it had been at prior.
Yep.
And part of that is because of the overbuild.
Yep.
But now that so there is scope. There's certainly not as if there's been heaps of extra building and they need to come back. Even just lifting up to sort of closer to levels they were in the early 2000s with a much smaller population.
It's quite a tight market, and in fact, when I say there, it's at new highs post GFC, that's actually a level previously would have been considered cyclical lows.
Yes.
Wow. So there's actually heaps of scope for it to keep going, as long as you've still got household formation, et cetera, and what have you. So so this is another key component to the reflation story. And if we flip over to the next chart, I'll show you why. That is, once US housing market rebounds and that supports the US consumer, then global industrial production usually follows the US consumer, given that a lot of the emerging markets, and Europe for that matter, because it's such a mercantilist economy, they're all yoked to US demand. Mm. In other words, they export to the US. So when the US consumer is strong, then the whole kind of industrial world tends to follow.
Mm.
And so that's another component to the argument, having supported with some more support for the US consumer and this industrial recession we've had over the last 12 months could come to an end. You can see on this chart that it's a pretty good correlation, although it doesn't always transpire. In the last mini cycle we had, for instance, the US consumer actually powered on when and industrial production fell, and that was because China was slowing very fast at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's important because we actually don't think industrial production can attract the US consumer very well this time either. And that's some evidence that they do diverge, even though typically they will follow one another. So that gives you your kind of three-pronged major components to the global reflation story. Mm. There are a few other elements to it. China is easing slowly but surely, but at the same time still is slowing, is our view. But it is easing, so that gets people excited.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the other really big one is car production globally. We've been through this extraordinary kind of global downturn in car production, driven in part by Europe and in part by China.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some hints that has eased a little. Car registrations have lifted a little in Europe. The rate at which they're falling in China has eased a little as well, but that still looks pretty troubled. They're the mainstays of the global reflation story. So if we pop over to the next chart, that starts to give you, your rational optimism. Which I'll toss over to Damo to explain.
Yes, this is a chart, and I'll just explain it for anyone listening in. So what I'm showing here is the price-to-earnings ratio of the US market, and it's pretty similar in other global economies, but this is a good one to look at. Price-to-earnings ratio on one axis in the blue, and then the EPS growth that you get in the following year.
Okay.
So what happens is usually you'd say, okay, the US PE's averaged about 15 over this time period, over about the last 15 years. And what you'd say is when it starts getting close to 18 or 19, the US market's getting expensive. So the price of the market compared to its earnings is 18 or 19 times higher. And if it gets down to sort of 11 or 12, then it's cheap.
Okay.
And so at face value, you'd say, okay, well, when the market's expensive, I'll sell it. And when the market's cheap, I'll buy it. And then I'll make money. But the over the last 15 years, that actually wasn't a particularly winning strategy. And one of the examples was 2003 is amusing for there. So 2003, the US market almost 19 times earnings.
Mm-hmm.
This is forward earnings. This is expected earnings. So there's already incorporating forecast in it. If you had bought then, over the next 2 years, you actually would have made about 15% on mm-hmm. the US market, a little bit more with dividends. But at the same time, the price to earnings actually fell back to below average because you've got the price at the top going up by 15%, but on the bottom, you had this massive earnings boom. You actually had a 40% increase in earnings that sort of meant that even though you bought it expensive... Yeah. It was justified because it was basically looking forward to saying, hey, there's all this extra earnings growth coming,
yep.
So you can pay up for the market.
Mm.
Same thing happens again in 2009 where, you're paying cyclical peaks, I suppose, for earnings and you're getting this massive earnings growth coming through. Then again, 2017, we had just prior to the Trump stimulus coming in and these big tax cuts, exactly the same story plays out again. So you get PEs hit sort of almost 19 times and... then you get this huge growth from huge earnings growth
yep.
over the next few years. So justified again in terms of buying. And so the question is, we're up to the fourth time in the last 15 years and valuations are getting quite expensive again. And, there's some that are out there arguing, well, this is just a sign that there's all this earnings, is about to come.
Yep.
And we're saying, well, we could see the argument in 2003, Fed was out there low interest rates pushing this huge housing boom building up. Mm-hmm. 2009 was basically just a recovery of earnings from prior lows in the financial crisis. And in 2017, we saw these tax cuts. We knew they were big, massive tax cuts. We saw that what they were going to do to earnings.
Yep.
2019/2020, it's very hard to see that, but we'll go into that in a little bit more detail. So there's one argument that says expensive valuations, you can justify them.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have to, I've cherry-picked this time period to show a nice one. You only have to go back three or four more years before this chart starts, and you get massive valuations in the tech boom.
Yeah,
that won't justify it.
Yep.
Or you go back over time, and quite often, and within other markets as well, quite often you will find valuations get expensive, mm-hmm. and then but you don't get the same earnings kick up. And so, other times you do. So I guess what I'm saying is, there are times where we're paying up for stocks is justified on the basis of the outlook.
Okay.
We just don't think that's the case right now.
And so with the forward earnings you were saying we've got here, so there's obviously this huge whipsaw effect, big departure. The forward earnings, so just going back over this, but the forward earnings for the subsequent year being down at the 0% mark.
Yeah.
This is the canary in the coal mine, effectively?
Yeah, so we obviously haven't got that for the most recent bit. So yep. so the latest number you can see there is if you had bought a year ago,
yep.
you would have paid whatever, 16 times earnings, say.
Yep.
And in the meantime, forward earnings have gone nowhere
over
the last year.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah, so sure. all the growth you've seen over the last year in share prices has been the valuation part of the market
yep.
getting more expensive and without the sort of support from underlying earnings.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. But irrational exuberance. Yeah.
Well, what Damo just described is a picture of irrational exuberance. And so the question is, do the earnings come through? And we're quite doubtful. And that's what the but's about. Here's a list of reasons why we're concerned that it won't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, going back to our sort of three pillars of the rebound, with the US consumer starting at number three,
mm-hmm.
The new tariff regime does a lot to derail the global spillovers from a strong US consumer into the global economy. Because you have all of these global supply chains, whatever, who are reorienting here and there. And some of that goes back to the US.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, other parts simply don't invest like they used to into new capacity because they're pulling it out and putting it somewhere else. And there's just a whole swathe of disruption in the supply chains that would normally fill up on the back of that rebounding US demand.
Mm-hmm.
And there's usually costs to changing your supply chain.
Yep.
You might get benefits from it. So you might be looking, saying, okay, well, I can reduce my cost per unit by 5% if I switch from China back and move it into the US or a different country.
Mm.
But there's an upfront cost you need to pay to get there.
Yep.
You need to go and spend that money. Yeah. And, yeah. So there's
profitability. Yep.
Central banks are a long way from being all in at this point.
So when you say that all in being...
Yeah, well, that's the question, what would all in look like? Yeah. But it's certainly not this.
Okay.
Like, the Fed is not even admitting it's doing QE4.
Mm.
It's simply sort of arguing it's doing short-term liquidity support. It's said its rate cutting cycle is over,
mm-hmm.
For now at least. It sees it as a mid-cycle support rather than any kind of, end-of-cycle desperate kind of move to where you're throwing in the kitchen sink.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the type of language where you get the, we'll do whatever it takes to get this going again and we'll spend.
Yeah. ECB is running into all sorts of problems in terms of doing more QE. But I'm sure they'll be overcome. But, they're there and it's new QE, although it was, material, wasn't huge. You've got Christine Lagarde coming in there now and, the great hope is that she'll be able to convince governments there to go fiscal
mm-hmm.
and spend, but there's very little sign of getting any traction at this point, Germany being the big one.
Yep.
And that would be a game changer if Europe were to suddenly spend big fiscally on investment in infrastructure, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not looking very promising at the moment. And China, is deleveraging. Not across the board, most certainly. Like, its overall credit growth is still up around 11%, but deleveraging its shadow banking system. PBOC still got holding a pretty tight rein. The rate cuts they've done have been very minimal, and they're clearly loath to do it. And to some extent, they can't do it. Some will argue that it's the pork prices, but I don't think that's really a big issue. They've got this pork apocalypse going with all the piggies dying. With I think it's African swine flu, isn't it? And that's driven consumer inflation through the roof, but that's temporary and they can look through it. The real problem here is the yuan in the midst of this trade war. The last thing that they want to see, you know, is the yuan tumbling as they're trying to get a trade deal done with Donald Trump, for obvious reasons. You know, the steam will come out of his ears and it could mushroom out of control. And so they really can't cut interest rates substantially until some kind of deal or new framework is worked out. And so China is still slowing and has got more slowing ahead, including we still think its housing market will slow. Prices are slowing. And mortgage growth is easing, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's a big one for commodities. Brexit is still likely. Looks like the Tories are going to win that election pretty easily.
We're not going to make too many political forecasts, though, given the state of politics.
globally. They've got a big, pretty sizable lead, it looks like. So
at the moment, it does look, according to all polling, it's more likely to happen than not happen.
It would probably end up being a soft Brexit. So, you know, arguably it's priced, but it still will result in further economic disruption for Europe, which throws up questions about how strong the euro can be. And then you end up with a stronger US dollar, which is difficult for a global reflation as well. And then, of course, the terrible things that are happening in Hong Kong seem inevitably to be coming to a kind of Tiananmen-style head of one form or another. The kiddies there are militarized almost now, and I just can't see any way out of that other than more violence. And that throws up an extraordinary curveball for politics everywhere. You can already see that with the US Congress turning on China big time, China turning on the Congress, Trump getting squashed in between. You got next year's election. You know, Trump will be wedged between his trade deal and the US kind of mythos of being the light on the hill for democracy. And the Dems will be going nuts over that, of course, forcing his hand. Doesn't necessarily have to disrupt the trade deal, but it certainly colours it in some way. Then you've got Europe, who sort of fancies itself as something of a moral superpower. If it goes badly in Hong Kong, I don't know what happens. Certainly Britain, you would expect to sanction China.
They might take it back.
They might try. I think that's a real risk that Europe does something to sanction China on trade, potentially. I mean, it's already getting very messy. China's starting to try and pull out of the US dollar and is buying European euro and European bonds. But the Europeans are going to hate that. And so there's Hong Kong is a grenade that you're throwing into a field of mines. I mean, it's... You just don't know how that works out, but none of it's very good. there are a few signals of something of a turn in global growth, but, you know, the argument that the political risk that was embedded in our second chart at the beginning about, you know, trade potentially turning for the better, that kind of hangs on geopolitical risk falling away, and that does not look, you know,
like it's
coming anytime soon.
And part of these as well is just companies' CapEx plans when they're planning big capital expenditure.
100%.
Is just coming back to saying, well,
wait.
We're not quite sure what's happening. All this stuff going on. Let's just hold off for 6 months and see. Let's wait till after the US election or whatever it is.
And then, of course, Hong Kong is... I can't remember the number. There's some enormous proportion of investment going into China goes through Hong Kong.
Yep.
Like, it is the global economy pivot into China with investment. So if Hong Kong gets crushed, then that investment's going to get crushed for some period of time, short, medium, or long. It's another shock, you know, for executives who are planning to invest in China. Yep. Personally, as well as the company, in terms of risk management, can I go into China right now? No.
Yeah.
You know. you know, there's a potential blow to Chinese growth in that as well. Quite a nasty one.
Mm.
That basically gives you some pretty nasty kind of headwinds on all three of the components of the global reflation story.
Mm.
So therefore, we basically think that the best case, even if we get a trade deal, you know, manages to squeak through the Hong Kong problem, especially.
Seems just highly unlikely until there's some sort of resolution, isn't it?
Well, like, they might do a deal, but it's so thin, it's not going to lift trade volumes particularly anyway.
Correct, yeah.
And in terms of restoring investment into the global supply chain between the US and China, when you've got Hong Kong going, well, it's not going to do anything.
Yeah,
but, and the trade deal that's been, like, just to put this in context, so you know, Trump started adding all these tariffs and wanted to do this big trade deal. And so, and there's talk about, you know, I think God knows how many times it's been announced that, yeah, it's just about to be signed. But it was mid this year that then they went, well, you know what, we're not going to be able to sign the big one, but we could sign something else. Let's sign a small one. And that's the one we're talking about now. Like, the small one was just like, oh, I'll buy a little bit of stuff from you and you buy a little bit of stuff from me. We'll try and play nicely, you know, while we're going through the big one. Like, this small one's it's very minor.
It's a rounding error positive stat, really.
So the fact that it's taken so much trouble just to get to this small one means the big one's got Buckley's moment.
Yeah, off the table.
And China wants to see a sort of schedule for tariff rollback, and the US knows that's lifting the pressure on them to deliver on anything.
Mm.
You know, I mean, before Hong Kong deteriorated so swiftly, you know, there's probably a fair argument that Trump might just, you know, shelve this until he gets through the election later next year and just capitulate for now, come back to it later if he wants to.
Yep.
But I don't know, it's just become much more difficult with Hong Kong.
And does the fact that, I guess, essentially the Hong Kong thing's brought the, you know, the human rights sort of element to the fore mean that, for example, if the Dems get in next election, this is just potential. We've got the potential for a rolling trade war, because now they've got, you know, it's not just an economic piece, it's now a
absolutely,
you know, it's a, you know, it's a political, and, you know,
President Bernie Sanders would be,
oh, you're coming back on the burn.
I'm saying President Bernie Sanders would be very
hesitant,
very anti-China,
exactly.
I think
they all will be.
They'll all be at least mildly, and depends upon, you know, which candidate you get. But yeah, some of them will be worse than Trump in terms of the hard line they take.
What's that bearded basketballer's name?
LeBron James.
LeBron. Yeah, he's not going to be very popular.
Person non grata.
Next 12 months. Anyway, cut a long story short. You know, we've had the big valuation run up in anticipation of better earnings as global growth rebounds. We see the rebound as troubled at best.
Okay.
And therefore, earnings, you know, will struggle to rebound and justify those multiples.
Yeah. There's this argument that goes that, and we've got a chart up now to showing the operating profit margin for the US market. So basically, what proportion of profits sort of end, what proportion of sales end up as profits? There is this argument that stocks are really in this Goldilocks zone because inflation's so low, and have been for a while, is that there's no cost pressure on wages. Mm. And so what's happening is, as wages keep getting held down, companies just keep on making all this money from it in terms of they can hold that through, and any revenue growth sort of goes into increasing margins. And so I've got this line up showing how profit margins from, you know, the early 90s were sort of a little bit over 5%. And now we're talking 12% profit margins. And it's just been a steady growth. Now some of that's actually just a flip between manufacturing and services. Services tend to have bigger profit margins, and you know, there's a lot of outsourcing, and there's all these things that go into that. So it's not completely apples with apples. I don't think we are going back to prior levels. But one of the things it is showing is, you know, we spoke about those big growth periods in profits being 2001, 2002, where we had this recovery of profits really from low levels back up to the trend line.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing in 2009, 2010. So we had these big booms in profits. So we had high PEs and big booms in profits, which brought us back up to the trend line again. In 2017, it was more about saying we're still on the trend line of profits, but we had these big tax cuts. And so that was what drove profits to an even higher level. And so now here we are sitting at what you'd arguably call a peak of earnings and peak of margins. And we're paying the same types of multiples we paid in these other times when earnings were depressed or we had these big tax cuts coming.
Yep.
And that sort of comes back to our core part is it's very hard to come up with an argument as to why profits are going to add another 20, 30% over the next 2 years, say, to justify where the current multiples are.
Mm. Okay.
So yeah, it's not that we disagree with some of the stories behind the reflation. There are stories there that have grains of truth.
Yep.
We just don't think that when you add all of them together and that all the positive scenarios, you get every single one of them come off the right way. It's very hard to see how that's going to lead to a 20-30% increase in profits because most of it is just about saying things won't get worse in the trade war or things won't go as badly as what's going to as what we thought might happen, but there's still no real sign that we're going to get that growth.
So everything's just got to go right to maintain the status quo, essentially.
Yeah, if everything goes right, even then, you know, we're saying okay, maybe 10% growth in profits.
Yep.
You know, it's not these big boom 20-30% years where all of a sudden overpaying for stocks becomes not an issue.
Yeah, sure. Okay. All right. Very good. So we'll roll across now into the investment outlook, and we've got a line there: patience is a virtue. I think that sounds quite reasonable given what's ahead of us.
Yeah, that's right. I think it just it's obviously when you see markets sort of running up at the end of cycles can be disconcerting for people, and it's like I've missed out, and what am I missing?
Yep.
And there were times, you know, we obviously jumped in quite early on that whole Trump. You know, taxes are being cut. You need to get exposure to these. Even though the markets look expensive, you need to jump in and buy that for the growth. Right now, we're telling you the opposite is that, you know, they look expensive. We can't see where this growth is coming from. We're happy to sit it out and maybe it will become apparent and there will be some sort of huge growth bit coming through that we can't see. But at the moment, it looks more that irrational exuberance rather than sort of rational optimism for on behalf of markets. So, yeah, staying patient. Sticking with our current weights, looking where we can trade out of some of the more expensive stocks and trade into some of the stocks that have been sort of rolled out, but having that key target list of stocks for when
the shopping list.
Yeah, the shopping list for when stocks do come back.
Yep. Okay. Pretty very good. For us.
Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe. Give us your email address, and in return, we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.